Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
It's been half a century since the United States passed the Voting Rights Act.
There is no cause for self-satisfaction in the long denial of equal rights of millions of Americans. But there is cause for hope and for faith in our democracy.
That, of course, was LBJ speaking way back in 1965. Meanwhile, a week and a half ago, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals concluded the Texas voter ID law has a discriminatory effect on poor and minority voters, but not that it was passed with the intention of discrimination. So why are we still fighting over access to the ballot and what it should mean? You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. While the act itself is widely recognized as a landmark achievement in American civil rights, it did not eliminate every possible obstacle between U.S. citizens and their ability to make their voices heard in elections. Changes to the VRA, each time it was renewed, have received less attention than the path to its passage. But as my guest can tell us, they have had significant impact over time and can help us understand the voting rights issues that continue to divide Americans today. Ari Berman is a political correspondent for The Nation and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. His new book is called Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Ari, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, Chris.
All right, I want to jump to current news first. The Fifth Circuit's ruling on the Texas voter ID law is a little bit confusing. The court says the law in its current form is in violation of the Voting Rights Act, but does not amount to a poll tax. What does that mean exactly?
Well, what the appeals court found was that the law is discriminatory against blacks and Hispanics because they are more likely than whites to not have the strict government-issued ID that is now required. So they agreed with the lower court on that ruling. They disagreed that it was a poll tax because Texas has now made the underlying documents that you need to get an ID, such as a birth certificate, for free if you're just trying to get them for the purpose of voting. And they also disagreed that this law was passed for intentional discrimination. So the lower court in Texas found that the law was passed not in spite of the fact that it discriminated against blacks and Hispanics, but because it would discriminate against blacks and Hispanics. And the appeals court said, maybe that's true, but you need more current evidence to back this up. You can't just look at Texas's history of voting discrimination. You have to find more recent examples from the legislatures during the voter ID debate. So that may be hard for the lower court to do. The last thing that happened is the court said that you need to also fashion a remedy. So they sent it back down to the lower court and they said, okay, you can strike down the strict voter ID requirement, but you have to require some sort of documentation. That might mean a voter registration card instead of a government-issued ID. It might mean an affidavit if you don't have a government-issued ID. But you need to fashion the remedy. We can't just strike this law down. We have to replace it with something. So it was largely a victory, I would say, for the Justice Department and the voting rights groups that were challenging the case, but it wasn't the total slam dunk victory they were looking for.
And while we're waiting for whatever remedy will ultimately be adopted, the provisions of the law stay in place?
Well, this is what is confusing people, because Texas is arguing that the law is still in effect. And there are local elections coming up in November, I believe. And I think there will be a remedy fashioned before then. I think if there was any election in the interim, the Justice Department and the voting rights groups would immediately go to the lower court and say, you need to figure out what the remedy is ASAP, because this law has been functionally struck down. So that's how I describe it. The law has been functionally struck down. It needs to be amended. It will be less strict than it was before. But in the meantime, theoretically, yes, it is still in effect.
Ari, Texas made it harder to present qualified ID than any other state. But does this ruling on the Texas voter ID law have implications for similar laws in other states?
It could have ramifications. I mean, every court is different. So you can't really project from one court to the next at either the district level or the appeals court level. What was significant about the Texas law, I think, was that the decision was written unanimously by a George W. Bush appointee, So you had a relatively conservative judge say that, yes, this voter ID law does violate the Voting Rights Act. And in fact, it was the first time that a federal appeals court has found that such a voter ID law violates the VRA. And so that was very significant, and that could have an impact on other states. Now, there's also a decent likelihood that this case is going to be appealed by Texas to the Supreme Court. And if that happens, then it has huge ramifications for other states, because the Supreme Court weighed in on voter ID laws in 2008 in a case from Indiana. It wasn't under the Voting Rights Act, and not that much was known about voter ID. And basically, the Supreme Court said in a 6-3 decision that even though there was no evidence of voter impersonation presented by Indiana to justify the law, that it seemed like a reasonable requirement to show government-issued ID. Now we know a lot more about voter ID laws. We know that a lot of people don't have them. We know that there are burdens associated with them. And so Justice John Paul Stevens, who wrote that Supreme Court opinion, has since said that the impact of the law is much more serious on poor and minority voters than he initially realized. And at the appeals court level, Judge Richard Posner, who wrote the opinion on the Indiana case at the appeals level, he has also said now that voter ID laws have much more to do with voter suppression than stopping voter ID laws. So there's been a big shift in how justices, in particular justices and judges, think about voter ID laws since the 2008 Indiana case. And if the Texas case comes up before the Supreme Court, it'll be interesting to see if there has been a rethinking, at least among five judges, on what the constitutionality of voter ID laws should be.
All right. On to the Voting Rights Act, specifically at this point, life before the Voting Rights Act. What kinds of provisions were put in place around the country to prevent racial minorities from exercising their rights to vote when, technically speaking, they had those rights under the Constitution?
Well, it's a very interesting and distressing history, because we passed three amendments after the Civil War to the Constitution to try to give full citizenship to African Americans, the 13th and the 14th and the 15th Amendment. And the 15th Amendment in particular said the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged on the basis of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. So it was pretty clear what the amendment was supposed to do. It was supposed to stop racial discrimination in voting. And for a brief period of time during Reconstruction, we did aggressively enforce the 15th Amendment. We sent federal troops to the South to register voters, to make sure elections were not stolen. There was a flourishing of black political power briefly in states like Mississippi. Then what happened was there was a disputed election in 1876. In return for the votes of some of the electoral states, Rutherford B. Hayes pulled federal troops out of the South. That led ultimately to the end of Reconstruction. And what you saw is that all the Southern states started passing things like literacy tests, poll taxes, grandfather clauses, residency requirements, all of which were intended to disenfranchise black voters. Some explicitly disenfranchise black voters, and some disenfranchise them based on the implementation. So many times you had a situation where African Americans could theoretically pass a literacy test, but it was always enforced in such a way that it was impossible for them to do so. And you had black professors who were very knowledgeable about the Constitution, who were not able to register to vote. And so it was a variety of voting changes that were done to try to disenfranchise voters. And then it was backed up by a climate of violence and of fear. So, for example, if you lived in a place like Selma, Alabama, and you were an African-American voter and you somehow were able to register to vote, your name was put in the newspaper, so everyone knew, and your address. So everyone knew where you lived, which made retribution very easy. And what we see over a period of time, since the end of Reconstruction until the Voting Rights Act, is that people are beaten, people are killed, people are disenfranchised over the right to vote.
This, I gather, is where the origin of the phrase grandfather clause comes from, by the way, that you had to demonstrate that you had a grandfather that was able to vote like before 1867 in a lot of states.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, if you were white, your grandfather was able to vote, you were grandfathered in. And if you were black, your grandfather was a slave and you were not able to vote. And so things like that were explicit. They may not have mentioned race, but they were explicitly racial in what they were designed to do.
And how was it that whites were exempted from things like literacy tests?
Well, not all whites were exempted. There still were efforts to disenfranchise poorer white voters. So it wasn't like it was totally exempting whites, but by and large, so much discretion was given to the registrars in places like Selma. They could do essentially whatever they wanted. So if you're an African American and you showed up to vote, they asked you to name all 67 county judges exactly, or else you weren't able to register. If you're a white person and you showed up, you might not have to do anything. They'd just sign you right up. And so it wasn't so much that the requirements themselves were discriminatory, although they were. It was that the implementation of them in terms of how states like Alabama chose to enforce the law, that was really where you saw the disenfranchisement happen.
Those tests, those literacy tests, would be almost comically difficult if the consequences had not been so dire.
Yeah, I mean, I like to show when I'm talking the Louisiana literacy test of 1964. And I mean, good luck deciphering that one. You need a PhD in quantum physics to try to figure this out. And of course, that's what I was saying, was that conservative white voters never faced this test and they never would have been able to pass it. But yet it was expected that African-American voters and Latinos and other minority groups would have to jump through all of these hurdles to do so. And the amount of time, the amount of energy, the amount of resources that were devoted to preserving white supremacy for so long in this country, it was just so unbelievably upsetting.
How did the Civil Rights Act of 1957 move the ball forward for voting rights?
Well, it was the first civil rights law passed by Congress in a very long time since Reconstruction, and it was a small first step. It did a few things. The most notable thing that it did was establish the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department and begin to give them some resources to start filing lawsuits against things like literacy tests and poll taxes. Now, the progress was very slow. The Justice Department didn't have a lot of resources. The Civil Rights Division in particular was not a priority for the Justice Department at the time. The Eisenhower administration wasn't super crazy about enforcing it, but nonetheless, it got the ball rolling.
But that law put the impetus on people with grievances to file lawsuits to challenge things that kept them from voting. And that was not always easy if the presiding judge harbored racist attitudes about black suffrage.
Well, that was the problem. The problem with the 57 Act and the 60 Act and the 64 Civil Rights Act was that the people that were facing the discrimination had to appeal to very conservative Southern courts who were not sympathetic to their aims. And so I don't want to jump ahead here, but what the Voting Rights Act was meant to do was shift this litigation away from conservative Southern courts and actually give both the federal government and voters some real recourse here to start knocking down things like literacy tests. Because before the VRA, you would file a lawsuit and it would just get bottlenecked in court forever. And even if it was eventually struck down after a period of years, a new requirement, a new voter suppression tactic was just implemented by a state like Alabama. And then you had to challenge that all over again. And so it was just really functionally impossible to strike these things down before the VRA.
Ari, why a Voting Rights Act that was passed legislatively rather than a constitutional amendment with the same provisions?
Well, it was just a lot quicker to pass it legislatively. I mean, a constitutional amendment is an enormous undertaking. And I mean, the Voting Rights Act was a very heavy lift before 1965. Famously, Martin Luther King, after winning the Nobel Peace Prize, goes to see Lyndon Johnson in late 1964 and tells them that he's going to Selma to launch the campaign for the Voting Rights Act. And Johnson says to King, that's great, but I'm not doing it this year. I have all these other great society priorities to deal with. Now, Johnson was telling his Justice Department to start preparing a Voting Rights Act. So this was something he wanted to do, but I think they thought it had to wait to 66, for example, because the Civil Rights Act of 64 was still so new. Then Selma happened, this dramatic atrocity where the entire country sees marchers getting beaten and bloodied simply for trying to bring attention to the denial of voting rights. And then you have a situation where Johnson realizes that he needs to move quickly and he can move quickly legislatively, that the Congress is so outraged, both Democrats and Republicans, and the Southern Democrats who have bottlenecked civil rights legislation for so long, their power has receded because of the moral urgency of Selma. And so LBJ realizes that he can do this legislatively. He doesn't have to go through a lengthy process. He can get the Voting Rights Act a lot quicker than he initially realized.
Ari Berman is my guest. He's political correspondent for The Nation and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. His new book is called Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with political correspondent for The Nation, Ari Berman. He has a new book out called Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Ari, there have been numerous depictions of LBJ that give a really complicated portrait of his commitment to civil rights. Anybody who saw the movie Selma got a pretty dark portrait of him. You've just characterized him as seeing an opportunity and seizing it after the marches from Selma to Montgomery.
LBJ was a political animal, and he was the product of his political environment. And when he was someone who represented Texas in the House and in the Senate, he voted the way that Texans did at that time on civil rights, which was very conservative. He didn't vote for any pieces of civil rights legislation until 1957. That said, I think he did care a lot about discrimination. When he was a teacher at a Mexican-American school in Cotulla, he felt the pain, as he described it, of discrimination, that the students he taught were so poor they couldn't even afford shoes. And I think that was a story LBJ told throughout his political career, and I think he understood what people in Selma were facing. And so when he became president, he had a change of constituency. He wasn't just representing Texas or the South. He was representing all Americans, and he was able to move legislatively in a way that he wasn't when he was someone who represented Texas. And so what you see both with the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and with the Voting Rights Act of 1965 is when opportunity presents itself, when the country is outraged and wants movement on these issues, LBJ is very shrewd in pushing these things through. And even though there was a critique of him that he moved too slowly on the Voting Rights Act, after Selma, he moved incredibly quickly. 8 days after Selma, he went before the Congress and introduced the Voting Rights Act. And 6 months after Selma, the Voting Rights Act was law. And not only was it law, but it survived completely intact from introduction to passage. So it wasn't weakened by conservative Southern Democrats. And I think LBJ used both his legislative power, but also the moral force of his presidency to really show why discrimination was wrong. And so I would urge everyone to listen to the speeches that he gave on March 15th, 1965, about the Voting Rights Act when he introduced it, and on August 6th, 1965, when he signed it. These are two of the greatest speeches ever delivered by an American president.
What's contained in the 24th Amendment, which was ratified in 1964?
Well, the 24th Amendment abolished the poll tax for federal elections, but it was the Voting Rights Act that then authorized the Attorney General to file suits abolishing the poll tax for all elections. And eventually that happened a year after the passage of the VRA.
Was there ever talk of rolling the provisions of the Voting Rights Act into the Civil Rights Act in 1964, or was that simply too much to put in a single piece of legislation?
There was talk of having a strong voting rights section of the Civil Rights Act, and it was cut precisely to get passage of the Civil Rights Act. So voting was always the thing that was sacrificed in these civil rights bills in 57 and 60 and 64. And that was why after the passage of three Civil Rights Act, you had to have a Voting Rights Act, because the right to vote was always sacrificed on the altar of other things. And Johnson realized that you couldn't solve any of these civil rights issues without the vote. He called it the meat in the coconut. He knew that the vote could give people power to change their circumstances in places like Selma.
When we look at partisan support for and opposition to the Voting Rights Act, it's important to remember that the Democratic and Republican parties of the mid-60s were not ideologically identical to the ones we have today. Can you give us a little bit of perspective on this?
They were very different. The Democratic Party was split. Southern Democrats, not exclusively, but were very conservative, and the rest of the Democratic Party was much more liberal. The Republicans really didn't have a presence in the South, so they were largely supportive of civil rights. What you see over the years is that the parties flip on this issue, that Democrats become much more supportive of civil rights laws, and Republicans start getting elected in the South and start becoming a lot more critical of civil rights laws. But it is true that not just in the 60s, but in the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, and even into the early 2000s, you have strong bipartisan support for the Voting Rights Act. And I think a lot of people think of the VRA as a piece of Democratic and liberal legislation because it was signed by LBJ during the heyday of the Great Society. But all four reauthorizations of the Voting Rights Act were signed by Republican presidents with overwhelming Republican support. So even if you had a President Nixon or a President Reagan or a President George W. Bush who didn't really like the Voting Rights Act, they were nonetheless forced to sign it because there was such strong bipartisan support in the Congress for the VRA.
What history did now Chief Justice John Roberts have with the Voting Rights Act over the course of his career?
He had a very long history with the Voting Rights Act. Roberts came to Washington in 1980. He first clerked for Justice William Rehnquist, who was the most conservative member on the court, particularly on civil rights issues. Rehnquist was someone who, when he lived in Arizona, administered literacy tests to Black and Hispanic voters at the polls. He said that Brown versus Board of Education was wrongly decided. He was very much an old school states' rights conservative, well after it was acceptable to be one. And so Roberts was first trained under Rehnquist, and then he goes and works in the Reagan Justice Department. And the Reagan Justice Department had launched a broad counter-revolution against civil rights. Reagan was not in favor of the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, or the Fair Housing Act. So he opposed all three major civil rights pieces of legislation from the 1960s. And Reagan wanted to roll back the enforcement of these laws. And his administration essentially argued that these things had become as bad as the original sin of representation, that things like affirmative action and quotas and drawing districts to benefit Black and Hispanic candidates, that all of this was a misguided effort to try to redress historic discrimination. And so John Roberts comes in the Reagan Justice Department after there was a case from Mobile before the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said that there could only be a violation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act if you had to show intentional discrimination, which was very, very difficult to prove. And the Congress wanted to overrule the Supreme Court when they reauthorized the Voting Rights Act of 1982 by saying that you just had to prove the result of discrimination, the effect of discrimination, not just the intent, which was very difficult. And Roberts was fighting tooth and nail as a young lawyer in the Reagan Justice Department to preserve the finding of intentional discrimination. And he argued in memo after memo after memo, very influential memos that went all the way to the top, that if you broaden the VRA, it would lead to things like affirmative action in the electoral sphere. And so 30 years later, when he became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and gutted the Voting Rights Act, it was not surprising to those of us who were familiar with his background as a young lawyer in the Reagan Justice Department.
When you say gutted the Voting Rights Act, you're referring to Shelby County v. Holder in 2013.
Yes.
That struck down the mechanism for preclearance. We'll explain what that is in a moment. That had been renewed as recently as 2006. How did the majority and Roberts specifically justify the elimination of the preclearance provision?
Well, so what they did is they struck down the formula that necessitated that those states with the worst histories of voting discrimination had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. And that covered much of the South, states like Texas, and also some western and northern states as well, but primarily the South. And what Roberts said in his decision was that history had changed since 1965, but the Voting Rights Act did not, that it continued to treat the country as if there were these racial distinctions that were no longer relevant in a country where you had the first Black president. And what was so interesting was that the Supreme Court basically held no deference to the long congressional record. They essentially argued, and Justice Scalia said this most prominently, that the very congressional reauthorization of the VRA, the overwhelming numbers in Congress, were evidence of its unconstitutionality. Because Scalia said, you know, the Voting Rights Act, that sounds so great. How could anyone be against that? And he attributed support for the law to what he called a quote-unquote perpetuation of racial entitlement, which I think was a very outrageous statement for many people to hear. And so the court, the five conservative justices on the court, felt like they were the only institution in American society brave enough to end this, because the Congress would never have the political will to either revise, curtail, or repeal the VRA. So the court had to do the heavy lifting that the Congress was unwilling to do.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. We have Mo on the line in Dallas. Hi, Mo.
Hi. Great topic.
Thank you.
My comment slash question is, where is the outrage from all the media outlet and from the people of this country when we have so many states passing voter suppression laws solely targeting minorities in order for the right-wing Republicans to win seats in Congress and in elections? It is fairly obvious what the outcome is.
Any thoughts on that, Ari?
Well, I do think that the issue of voting rights has been very undercovered. I noticed in early 2011, I began writing about this issue because all these states, whether it was Florida or Ohio or Texas or Wisconsin, started passing new voting restrictions, things like shutting down voter registration drives, cutting early voting, purging the voting rolls, requiring government-issued ID to cast a ballot. These were all new things that suddenly all these states across the country in a very coordinated way were doing, and no one was really covering it. So I wrote about it first for Rolling Stone, and then I kept writing about it for The Nation, precisely because it wasn't being covered. And I wanted to write this book in particular because after the Voting Rights Act was challenged, I realized that people didn't really understand what the Voting Rights Act did, that this history hadn't really been told before. A lot of people knew about Selma. They knew what led to the passage of the VRA, but the history that happened after was not well understood. And so it wasn't just that the current effort to make it harder to vote wasn't being covered, but the whole history of the VRA itself wasn't being covered. And I felt like that was a really, really important story that needed to be told.
You trace new restrictions on voting rights or new impediments to the right to cast a ballot to the election of President Obama.
Well, it's absolutely true that if you just look at the data, the number of voting restrictions skyrocketed after President Obama. From 2011 to 2015, 468 new voting restrictions were introduced in 49 states, and half the states in the country adopted new voting restrictions following the 2010 election. Nothing like that occurred in 2000 or 2004, let alone in the decades since then. There have always been efforts to try to subvert the Voting Rights Act. There have always been efforts to try to make it harder to vote. But the escalation of these efforts after President Obama's election was really, really dramatic. And I saw it as a very clear attempt to try to make the electorate older, whiter, and more conservative, as opposed to younger, more diverse, and more progressive. And you look at a state like Texas, which in many ways is the epicenter of the voting rights struggle. Texas is the perfect case study because the demographics are changing so rapidly. And you have a situation where the Democratic Party in Texas is very diverse and the Republican Party in Texas is very white. And so those people that are in power feel very threatened by the demographic changes. And they're going to do whatever they can to try to prevent those demographic changes from becoming a political reality. And I think that's why we're seeing, following the election of the first black president, so many efforts to make it harder to vote. This is what we saw after Reconstruction. This is what we saw after the Civil War in response to all the progress that the country had made. And we're seeing the same type of efforts in different forms, more sophisticated forms, following the election of Barack Obama as well.
Has voter fraud been a statistically significant problem at any point in our history?
No, especially not now. Texas presented so little evidence of voter impersonation at the two voter ID trials. So this isn't just a theoretical conversation here. In Texas in particular, we've had two very lengthy trials over the voter ID law. And Texas has only been able to point to two cases of voter impersonation over a decade, while at the same time exempting absentee ballots from the voter ID requirement, where even though absentee ballots is where voter fraud is more likely to happen. And so I find this to be very ironic that if you look at fraud in American elections, it's not a major problem. The fraud that does exist is much more likely to be absentee ballots than it is to be a strict voter ID law. Yet so many of these voter ID laws also exempt absentee ballots, which makes me think that it's not a good faith effort to try to crack down on the problem of voter fraud, but that something else is at play.
All right. What else was particularly important in the Voting Rights Act in 1965? We've already talked about preclearance, but talk about some of the other measures that made a really important difference.
Well, the first thing the Voting Rights Act did was it knocked down all of those voter suppression techniques that we talked about earlier, things like literacy tests and poll taxes. And so as opposed to trying to have to go to the courts and strike all of this down, it basically abolished literacy tests overnight in the places where those tests were used to disenfranchise black voters. Then it sent federal observers, then it sent federal examiners to the South to register voters. And that was a huge, dramatic, revolutionary change. So you actually had federal officials signing up people in places like Selma, Alabama, where only 2% of African Americans were registered to vote. And what you see is that hundreds and then thousands and eventually millions of people are registered because of this effort. Then federal observers stayed in the South to make sure that elections weren't stolen, that states actually complied with the act. And then over a longer period of time, as you mentioned earlier, those states with the worst histories of voting discrimination had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. That was all as a result of the 1965 reauthorization of the VRA. The 1975 reauthorization of the VRA is the next huge thing that happens because the act is expanded to protect Latinos and other language minority groups. So Asian Americans, Native Americans, all sorts of different groups that may speak a language other than English. And that was critical for two reasons. Number one, it mandated bilingual ballots and bilingual election materials in places where you had a significant language minority concentrations, because English-only ballots had functioned as a de facto literacy test in places like Texas. Then what it did is those states that had a large language minority population and a history of discriminating against them, it forced those states to also have to approve their voting changes with the federal government. And Texas was one of those states that was covered because of the 1975 reauthorization of the VRA. And that was so significant because Texas is not just such a huge state, but Texas became, in the years after that, I'm sad to say, the most frequent violator of the Voting Rights Act. If you look at the last 25 years alone, Texas had 164 voting rights violations. That was double the number of the next closest state, Louisiana. And so the fact that you were able to cover a place like Texas was extremely significant in terms of the broadening of the Voting Rights Act.
And the 1975 reauthorization was spearheaded in large part by Barbara Jordan of Texas.
Yeah, so Texans are involved on many levels in the reauthorization. First off, Barbara Jordan from Houston felt like the same kind of discrimination that was happening against African Americans in the 60s was happening to Latinos in the 1970s. So she pushed really hard to broaden the act. At the same time, you had groups like the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund bring Latino activists to Texas to talk about the discrimination they faced. And they faced many of the same problems that African Americans in the 60s face. The fact that ballots were printed only in English and served as a de facto literacy test, that there was economic and physical retribution against people that tried, Latino groups that tried to exercise their right to vote, that districts were gerrymandered in such a way to prevent Latinos from being elected. So all these forms of discrimination that were faced in the 1960s by African Americans were faced by Latinos in the 1970s, and that persuaded the Congress to broaden the VRA.
Ari Berman is my guest. He's an investigative journalism fellow at the Nation Institute and political correspondent for The Nation. His new book is called Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Ari Berman, a political correspondent for The Nation and author of the new book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Ari, were the Voting Rights Act's effects on voter turnouts and the kind of candidates being elected apparent right away upon its passage?
Their effect on voter turnout was on voter registration was dramatic, and then eventually on voter turnout was dramatic. The election of candidates took a long time. It took a long time to strike down the discriminatory election systems that had prevented that were enacted to prevent African Americans and other minority groups from actually being able to exercise the value of their vote. And so what you see is that you don't really start to see people like Barbara Jordan get elected until the early 1970s, and it takes much longer, until the 80s and 90s, for there to be a real surge in minority voting population, in minority voting power. And that's what was surprising to me, that people like John Lewis, the civil rights leader from Atlanta, that he wasn't elected to the Congress until 1987. At the time that he was elected to the Congress, there were only two African-American members of Congress from the entire South. And so it took decades to make the promise of the Voting Rights Act real.
We have an email here from a listener who says, I'd like to hear why the requirement to present government ID is a significant hindrance to legitimate voters.
Well, it's a hindrance for a few reasons. Number one, we know from these trials in Texas that not everyone has a government-issued ID, that around 5% of the electorate, which equals 600,000 voters in Texas, don't have a government-issued ID. So the idea that everyone has one is not true. The second problem is that not everyone has access to the underlying documents needed to obtain an ID. Not everyone has a birth certificate, or not everyone can afford what was previously required to get a birth certificate. So they don't have $22 to get one, or they don't have hundreds of dollars if you have to get one expedited and notarized. If you were born at home in a segregated South, like people were in Texas, elderly voters were in Texas, you never got a birth certificate. So it's very difficult to even get that voter ID. And you know, the third thing is that there's difficulties having access to the necessary services to obtain one. So, for example, a third of counties in Texas don't have a DMV office. So if you don't have a driver's license and you don't drive and you live in a county in Texas that doesn't have a DMV office, how are you supposed to get to an adjoining county that could be, in some cases in Texas, hundreds of miles away? And so there are not just, it's not just the fact that people don't have this ID. There's all these other underlying things that make it harder. And that's why the courts have repeatedly found that the burden of these voter ID laws is strongest among lower income residents and among Black and Hispanic voters in Texas who have been previously and historically disenfranchised.
If states, including Texas, make it significantly easier to obtain a government-issued ID, will that satisfy people who think that ID requirements are inherently unfair?
I think that if you required something like a utility bill or a bank statement or a social security card or a voter registration card, that would satisfy most of the critics. I can only speak for myself. I don't have any problem with people requiring an ID. I have a problem requiring an ID that people don't have and that has a discriminatory effect in terms of how it's done. And if you look at the data, it's very clear that not every qualified voter has a government-issued ID, that there isn't a need for one based on the lack of voter impersonation fraud, and that the people who don't have these IDs are these historically marginalized communities. And I don't think we should be making it harder for them to vote.
Is it fair to say that both parties today try to endorse voting rights legislation that seems most favorable to their own political fortunes?
Well, I think there's something of a false equivalence here, because I don't think that Democrats making it easier to vote is the same as Republicans making it harder to vote. So I don't think there is an equivalence there. It's certainly true that things like same-day voter registration or early voting, for example, expanded voting opportunities help Democrats because Democratic voters are less reliable than Republican voters. But these policies help everybody. There's no reason that Republicans can't use same-day voter registration or can't use early voting, for example. And in fact, Republicans are using them in states like Wisconsin that have these reforms. And so I'm weary of making the comparison that both parties are just doing it for political reasons. I think that no matter which party is doing it, they should be commended for expanding voting rights. And I think no matter which party is doing it, they should be criticized for trying to restrict voting rights. I didn't come at this as a partisan observer. I came at this as a journalist who was very disturbed by efforts to try to make it harder to vote, particularly as we near the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act and the election of the country's first Black president.
Ari, what was the relationship between the Voting Rights Act and the passage of the or the ratification of the 26th Amendment, lowering the voting age to 18?
Well, it's interesting. So the 26th Amendment lowered the voting age to 18 for federal elections, and then the Voting Rights Reauthorization of 1970, signed by Richard Nixon, lowered the voting age to 18 for all elections. So that was another thing the VRA did, was that it brought millions of new voters into the process by lowering the voting age for 18. And what people have to realize is the broadening of the VRA, giving 18-year-olds the right to vote, expanding protections for Latinos and other language minority groups. This was something that helped a wide variety of Americans. So the Voting Rights Act wasn't just a piece of legislation that helped exclusively African-American voters. It really became the prime vehicle to expand voting rights for all Americans.
Talk a little bit about the struggle that many jurisdictions, many candidates get simply to bring out voters, period. I mean, we talk so much about voting rights in this country, and I think justifiably so. At the same time, there are lots of people who are able to vote that choose not to. What's going on?
Well, I mean, the sad reality is that we already have such bad participation, and then we do things like make it harder for people to participate. I'll give you one example. If you want to register voters in Texas, you have to be deputized by the county, and you actually have to be deputized at the county courthouse during a very limited period of time. And people say, why are there 2.5 million unregistered Latinos in Texas? Well, one reason is because it's so hard to register them. It's so hard to deputize all these people and to do the significant organization that's needed to try to then get out and register everybody. So states like Texas are not encouraging people to be registered who are left out of the political process. Then you just have a situation that even if you're able to register and participate, there are just not very many good choices out there, that we have a political system that is too often dominated by which candidates raise the most money. And that's not just apparent at the presidential level, but it's present at all levels. In a huge state like Texas, to run for Senate, to run for governor is extremely expensive. And so there are lots of compromises made by these candidates before they even decide to run. And so that's why I think that the weakening of the Voting Rights Act, the Citizens United decision, the widening economic inequality in our country, they're all related in terms of an attempt to try to enhance the power of a small group of people while making it harder for the rest of the people to either participate in the political process or really have a real choice in terms of who they vote for.
Have you given this a lot of thought? Do you think a President Kennedy, had he still been alive and had he been president in 1965, would he have been any more or less an advocate for the Voting Rights Act than his successor?
It's hard to say. The Kennedy administration was very cautious and was very aware of their image. And so you did have Bobby Kennedy at the Justice Department beginning to move on civil rights. But JFK was weary of going too quickly. And someone like Lyndon Johnson, who really had nothing to lose once he became president, never thought he would be president. It wasn't something like was necessarily destined for him in the same way that it was for Kennedy, who had all the good looks and the family name and the money. I think that LBJ would have taken advantage and did take advantage of the situation in a way that maybe Kennedy would not have. That LBJ, because of his knowledge of the Congress, because he came from Texas, a state where there had been a lot of discrimination, and because, you know, he kind of became president by accident, all of this stuff really made him want to seize the political moment and do things as quickly as possible on every single front. I mean, if you look at the legislation that LBJ passed during a short period of time, nothing, with the exception of FDR, compares to it.
What is the mechanism for renewing the Voting Rights Act? Are they regular intervals, or does each renewal sort of set the date for the next time the law will be reexamined?
Well, Congress had that power. So the not all of the VRA needed to be renewed, but parts of it did, particularly the requirement that you had to approve your voting changes with the federal government. So initially, it was due to expire in 1970, and then it was reauthorized for another 5 years. And then it was due to expire in 75, and then it was reauthorized because discrimination didn't end. And then in 82, it was reauthorized for 25 years because they realized that you needed to have a long period of time for the VRA to actually work. And then in 2006, it was reauthorized again for another 25 years. And I think, you know, people thought that that would sort of end the debate about the Voting Rights Act for a while. But that very reauthorization then became cause to challenge it because opponents of the VRA said, listen, Congress is going to reauthorize this thing indefinitely. So we have to challenge this in the court and the courts have to step in as a check to Congress. And again, that gets back to what I was saying earlier, that these five justices on the court felt like they could do the heavy lifting that Congress was unwilling to do.
We have an email here from Joey in Denton who says, how likely is the scenario that there will be ramming through of new voter laws just before elections? Those laws will stay in place through the elections if no lawsuit is brought against them.
Well, I'm very concerned about this because 2016 is going to be the first presidential election in 50 years without the full protections of the VRA. What that means is that states like Texas that previously had to submit their voting changes to the federal government, they don't have to do so anymore. And that means that they could pass voting changes right before the election, not just on the state level, but on the local level as well. And they'll be very difficult to challenge before the election. The other thing that I'm worried about is states coming back in, state legislative sessions starting in 2016, and them passing new voting restrictions before the election. A number of states held their fire in 2015 and didn't pass new restrictions, but it's very possible they could do this before the election. And so I'm very concerned about the possibility of lots of election changes happening before the election and being difficult to stop.
How often has the Justice Department stepped in and exercised its preclearance power to stop a change to a state's voting law?
Well, many, many times. They have blocked 3,000 voting changes since 1965, and I mentioned Texas alone. The fact that Texas had 164 voting rights violations in the last 25 years just shows you that voting discrimination is not a thing of the past, that this is still something that's part of our very recent future. And so when you take away the most important tool that the federal government had for stopping voting discrimination, you're opening the door for a lot of potentially negative things to happen.
Nobody would go on record as saying they are against full voting rights for every U.S. citizen who should have them. How is it, is there a way to frame this conversation so that you don't have people feeling like adversaries, but you have Americans looking at the impediments to the exercise of the right to vote in a sort of politically neutral context?
Well, I do think there is a segment of the population that believes that voting should be a privilege and not a right. And so I think you have certain people make this argument explicitly that not everyone should participate. But I think more broadly, I think you're correct that Americans do believe that there should be higher voter participation. And so my frame is, you know, take out some of the politicization that has occurred in recent years and just talk about, you know, things that make it easier to vote and things make that make it harder to vote. And we know there are certain things, you know, like early voting, like same-day voter registration, that make it easier to vote. And there are certain things like, you know, shutting down voter registration drives, requiring voter ID laws, et cetera, that make it harder to vote. And it is unfortunate that instead of looking at this from an empirical perspective, we're looking at it through a partisan lens instead.
What's most prominent on your radar screen as a journalist who covers voting rights issues as we move toward 2016?
Well, there's a few things. Number one, are there going to be lots of new voting changes before the 2016 election? Number two, there's a significant case before the Supreme Court from Texas about how districts should be drawn. Should everyone be counted or just eligible voters? If it's just eligible voters, districts will become a lot more conservative and less diverse than they are now. And then the third thing that I'm looking out for is just kind of more broadly, like what states are doing to try to make it easier to vote, because I do think that there has been, you know, a major attempt to make it harder to vote. But there's also a bunch of states like California, big blue states that are trying to adopt measures to make it easier to vote. Oregon, for example, just passed automatic voter registration. So anytime you have any contact with the DMV, you're automatically registered to vote, and it's on the voter to opt out. And that's going to add, in Oregon, thousands of people to the rolls, and in other states like California, potentially millions of people to the rolls. So I'm not just looking at the backlash to voting rights. I'm also looking at the expansion of voting rights as well.
Ari Berman is a political correspondent for The Nation and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. His new book is called Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Ari, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks so much, Chris. That was great.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter. My handle is Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.